In the shadows of religious purity lies a tale that has captivated millions of readers, climbing bestseller charts and sparking heated discussions across social media platforms. Jesse Hall's That Sick Love doesn't just push boundaries, it obliterates them, exploring the darkest corners of desire, revenge, and liberation. This controversial novel has become a cultural phenomenon, with hashtag ThatSickLove trending on TikTok as readers debate its provocative themes. Even celebrities like Megan Fox have praised its unflinching examination of religious hypocrisy and sexual awakening. What makes this story so compelling is not just its explicit content, but how it forces us to question the institutions we trust and the desires we suppress in the name of righteousness. At its core, That Sick Love is a scathing critique of religious institutions that preach purity while harboring corruption. Bryony Strait, a 20-year-old woman raised in a strict religious community, finds her carefully constructed world unraveling when she discovers a blood-red rosebud in her trash can, the calling card of a mysterious stalker who calls himself Arrow. As the newly appointed first female Magnus Princeps of her church, Bryony represents the pinnacle of feminine purity and virtue, a role that demands absolute adherence to the church's strict moral code. Her appointment breaks centuries of male-dominated tradition, creating immediate tension within the church hierarchy and exposing deep-seated misogyny masked as religious doctrine. The novel meticulously exposes how religious authority figures use scripture to justify abuse and maintain control. Bishop Caldwell, a respected church leader celebrated for his charitable works and passionate sermons, has been sexually abusing young boys, including Arrow in his childhood. His position of authority allows him to manipulate both scripture and church policy to silence victims, often twisting passages about forgiveness and obedience to maintain his power. The deacon attempts to drown Bryony during her baptism ceremony, an act he later justifies as cleansing the church of corruption. St. Westwood, the golden boy destined to become bishop, participates in schemes to undermine Bryony's position while publicly praising her appointment as God's will. These men don't just commit sins, they weaponize religion to justify their actions and silence their victims, creating a web of complicity that extends throughout the church hierarchy. What makes this critique particularly powerful is how Hall contrasts external religious performance with internal moral bankruptcy. Characters quote scripture while plotting murder, their biblical knowledge serving as a shield for their darkest intentions. They preach forgiveness while holding grudges that span generations, using church gossip networks to destroy reputations. They condemn sexual impurity while engaging in the worst forms of exploitation, often targeting the most vulnerable members of their congregation. The novel particularly emphasizes this hypocrisy through its ritual scenes, elaborate ceremonies of purification conducted by morally corrupt leaders, highlighting the growing gap between religious performance and genuine spiritual practice. Through Bryony's awakening, we see how institutions designed to protect can become the most dangerous threats when power corrupts their leadership. Her journey from blind faith to questioning believer mirrors many real-world experiences of religious trauma. The novel doesn't attack faith itself, but exposes how easily religious frameworks can be manipulated to serve the powerful at the expense of the vulnerable. Hall's narrative particularly shines in depicting the subtle ways religious authority maintains its grip, through social pressure, financial control, and the threat of spiritual condemnation. The story serves as a powerful reminder that true faith must be distinguished from institutional power structures that often betray their spiritual foundations. Arrow's obsession with Bryony initially manifests as classic stalking behavior, leaving roses, watching her sleep, and sending cryptic messages. Yet Hall subverts our expectations by revealing that this obsession stems not from a desire to harm, but to protect. Arrow's fixation becomes the catalyst for Bryony's liberation from the constraints of her religious upbringing. I'm your god now, Arrow declares in an early message, establishing the novel's central tension between traditional religious authority and a new, darker form of devotion. His stalking is methodical and calculated, designed to awaken Brioni to her own power rather than simply control her. He leaves weapons within her reach, testing whether she'll fight back. He creates scenarios that force her to question her beliefs. Each rosebud he leaves symbolizes potential, a life cut short before it can bloom, mirroring how Brioni's true self has been stunted by religious oppression. The psychological complexity deepens as we learn that Arrow's obsession is rooted in his own trauma. As Callum Westwood's illegitimate son, he was rejected by his father and subjected to sexual abuse by Bishop Caldwell. His fixation on Brioni stems partly from recognizing a kindred spirit, another stain the church would prefer to erase. Their relationship evolves from stalker-victim to mentor-student to equals united against common enemies. Hall masterfully portrays how trauma can distort love and protection into something unrecognizable to outsiders, yet perfectly logical to those involved. When Arrow tells Brioni, "I'd bleed out for you, I'd kill anyone so you could live, I'd follow you to your grave," he's expressing devotion in the only language his damaged psyche understands. The novel forces readers to confront uncomfortable questions. Can obsession ever be redemptive? Can someone who's been broken by violence use that same violence to protect another? Brioni's journey from obedient church daughter to vengeful force of nature represents one of the novel's most compelling arcs. Her transformation isn't simply about embracing sexuality, it's about claiming agency in a world designed to deny her power. As the first female Magnus Princeps, she initially believes she can work within the system to effect change. However, she gradually realizes that the entire structure is designed to keep women subordinate. The novel highlights the double standards applied to women in religious communities. When discussing how a girl named Erin is labeled the town whore while her male partner escapes judgment, Brioni reflects on the church's hypocrisy, how forgiveness is preached but never truly granted to women who transgress sexual boundaries. This realization becomes a turning point in her understanding of how patriarchal power operates. Arrow's role in Brioni's iteration is complex. He simultaneously objectifies her, calling her his doll and claiming ownership of her body, while encouraging her to develop her own strength and autonomy. He tells her, "I am yours as much as you are mine," suggesting a relationship of equals despite the power imbalance. His ultimate goal isn't to control her, but to help her find her voice. "It was never my job to protect you," he explains. His goal was always for her to protect herself. By the novel's end, Brioni has fully claimed her power. She orchestrates the downfall of the corrupt church leadership, confronts her biological father, and even turns the tables on Arrow by drugging and dominating him. Her declaration, "I'm not an object, you don't own me," marks her final rejection of all forms of patriarchal control, whether from the church or from her lover. The novel suggests that true liberation requires not just breaking free from obvious oppression, but recognizing the subtle ways we internalize controlling narratives. Sex in That Sick Love is never just about pleasure. It's a weapon, a tool for manipulation, a form of communication, and ultimately a path to reclamation. The novel explores how sexuality can be both a source of power and vulnerability, often simultaneously. Brioni's sexual awakening parallels her growing awareness of the corruption around her, as if her body's responses are revealing truths her mind hasn't yet accepted. This duality becomes particularly evident in scenes where her physical responses betray her, even as her conscious mind struggles against recognizing uncomfortable truths about the church's corruption. The sexual encounters between Brioni and Arrow evolve throughout the narrative, reflecting their changing power dynamics. Initially, Arrow dominates completely, using sex to break down Brioni's religious conditioning. These scenes are deliberately transgressive, taking place in a confession booth, involving religious artifacts, mixing pleasure with pain. They're designed to shock not just Bryony, but readers as well, forcing confrontation with taboos that religious upbringings often create. The author particularly emphasizes the symbolism in these encounters, such as when Arrow uses a rosary as a bondage tool, directly challenging the intersection of sacred and profane. As Bryony grows more confident, she begins to use her sexuality strategically. She seduces Saint as part of their revenge plan, carefully orchestrating each encounter to gather information while maintaining emotional distance. She performs as a stripper to infiltrate the club where Arrow is being tortured, transforming what could be exploitation into empowerment. The scenes in the strip club are particularly nuanced, showing how Bryony learns to weaponize the male gaze while simultaneously subverting it. By the novel's conclusion, she's able to dominate Arrow sexually, helping him reclaim his body from the trauma of childhood abuse. This reversal completes her transformation from object to subject, from being acted upon to taking action. The novel doesn't shy away from exploring the darker aspects of desire. Both protagonists are aroused by violence, control, and even pain, with scenes that blur the line between pleasure and suffering. Yet Hall avoids simplistic judgments about these desires, instead suggesting that in a world where sexuality has been weaponized against them, reclaiming even the darkest aspects of desire becomes an act of rebellion. When Bryony says, "Destroy my purity, Arrow, dirty me with your demons," she's not just expressing sexual desire, but rejecting the entire framework that defined her worth through sexual purity. This declaration becomes a turning point in the narrative, marking her complete rejection of the church's authority over her body and sexuality. The author weaves themes of power exchange throughout intimate scenes, showing how sexual dynamics mirror larger social and political conflicts. Each encounter between characters becomes a negotiation of power, identity, and agency. The novel suggests that in a world where institutions use sexuality as a means of control, the most radical act might be reclaiming it for oneself, even or especially in its most transgressive forms. Both protagonists carry deep psychological wounds that shape their behaviors and relationships in profound and complex ways. Arrow's childhood sexual abuse by Bishop Caldwell has left him unable to accept gentle touch without experiencing intense flashbacks and dissociative episodes. He associates tenderness with violation, requiring pain before pleasure to feel safe, a coping mechanism that allows him to maintain control over intimate encounters. Bryony's trauma manifests differently but cuts equally deep. The slow erosion of selfhood through religious indoctrination that taught her to deny her own desires and submit to patriarchal authority. Her conditioning runs so deep that even basic decisions about her body and desires trigger waves of shame and guilt. The novel meticulously explores how trauma survivors often recreate familiar dynamics, even harmful ones, because they provide a sense of control and predictability in an uncertain world. Arrow's need to dominate sexually stems directly from his experience of powerlessness as a child, transforming him from victim to controller. His obsessive protection of Bryony reflects his deep-seated guilt over his failure to protect his mother from abuse. Even his methods, using religious language and symbols to manipulate Bryony, mirror how he was manipulated by Bishop Caldwell, demonstrating the insidious way trauma patterns repeat across generations. Through carefully crafted scenes and internal monologues, That Sick Love suggests that trauma cycles can be broken through conscious effort and genuine connection. The healing process begins when Bryony recognizes Arrow's triggers and works to help him reclaim his body. I recite scripture as my fingers explore Arrow's body, working to rewrite his past with gentle touches. This pivotal scene powerfully illustrates how intimacy can be reparative when it acknowledges rather than ignores past wounds. Their breakthrough moments come not from avoiding their trauma, but from facing it together. Whether through role reversal exercises, trauma-informed therapy techniques, or simply holding space for each other's pain. The novel doesn't offer easy solutions or promise complete healing. Both characters remain visibly damaged at the story's conclusion, still struggling with nightmares, panic attacks, and deeply ingrained maladaptive behaviors. However, they found in each other someone who understands their specific brokenness. We're violently ripped from the same dirtied cloth, as Brioni poignantly observes. Their relationship, while unconventional and often disturbing to outsiders, provides a framework for mutual recognition and understanding that their previous worlds denied them. Through their journey, the author demonstrates how trauma survivors can find healing not in perfect recovery, but in the messy, complicated process of being truly seen and accepted by another wounded soul. That Sick Love is fundamentally a revenge narrative, exploring what happens when institutional justice fails and victims take matters into their own hands. Arrow's elaborate plan to destroy the church leadership unfolds throughout the novel, revealing layers of calculation that initially appear as random acts of violence or obsession. His methodical approach, cultivating relationships, gathering evidence, and positioning key players, demonstrates the careful architecture behind what others perceive as chaos. The revenge plot works on multiple levels, each layer revealing deeper motivations and consequences. There's personal vengeance, Arrow systematically punishing those who abused him and orchestrated his mother's death, including the strategic dismantling of Saint's reputation before his ultimate downfall. There's protective revenge, eliminating threats to Brioni's safety and position, exemplified by the calculated removal of Jacob and his enablers. And there's systemic revenge, exposing the hypocrisy of the entire religious institution through the viral video of Saint's assault on Brioni, which serves as both personal retribution and public revelation. Hall explores the moral complexity of vigilante justice without offering easy answers, weaving questions of ethics throughout the narrative. The novel's villains are undeniably evil, child abusers, murderers, and manipulators who have escaped legal consequences through their positions of power and careful manipulation of church hierarchy. Yet the protagonist's methods, torture, murder, sexual manipulation, mirror the very violence they're punishing. This moral ambiguity is encapsulated when Brioni justifies killing Alistair Abbott. He talked too much, and yet had nothing worth saying. The statement reflects both cold pragmatism and moral judgment, suggesting that some actions can be both necessary and morally questionable. The novel suggests that when systems are thoroughly corrupt, working within them becomes impossible, a theme reinforced through multiple character arcs and institutional failures. Traditional justice failed both protagonists. Arrow was imprisoned for crimes he didn't commit, while evidence against the real perpetrators was buried, while Brioni's complaints about Jacob's assault were systematically dismissed and covered up by church authorities. Their extrajudicial actions become, in their view, the only path to true justice. As Brioni quotes from Isaiah, "Learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, bring justice to the fatherless, and plead the widow's cause." This biblical reference serves both as justification and indictment, highlighting how religious institutions can pervert the very principles they claim to uphold. The narrative particularly excels in showing how revenge transforms its practitioners. Both Arrow and Brioni begin their quest seeking simple retribution, but evolve into architects of systematic destruction, raising questions about whether justice sought outside the law can ever truly remain just. Throughout the novel, both protagonists struggle with fundamental questions of identity. Who are they beyond the labels assigned to them? What parts of themselves are authentic, and what parts are reactions to trauma or conditioning? The journey towards self-knowledge takes them through increasingly dark territory, suggesting that sometimes we must confront our capacity for darkness to discover our true selves. Bryony's identity crisis is central to the narrative. Raised to be the perfect religious daughter, she discovers she's actually an orphan. Her real mother murdered by the church leadership, her adoptive parents conveniently disappeared on a mission trip. This revelation shatters her understanding of herself, leaving her adrift. She confesses her desire to know her origins, feeling lost without knowing where she belongs. Arrow's identity has been defined by rejection and violence. As Callum Westwood's illegitimate son, he was labeled a horrible stain and dirt brushed under many an old rug. His criminal skills were exploited by Alistair Abbott, who saw him merely as a weapon. His journey involves reclaiming his identity from those who tried to erase or use him. Their relationship becomes the space where both can discover who they truly are beyond social expectations or trauma responses. We're not like others, Bryony realizes. We're like us. This simple statement represents a profound rejection of external definitions and the creation of an identity based on mutual recognition rather than social norms. The novel suggests that self-discovery sometimes requires embracing rather than denying our darkest impulses. When Bryony finally accepts her capacity for violence and manipulation, she gains power over those who tried to control her. When Arrow allows himself to receive gentle touch despite his trauma, he reclaims parts of himself that abuse had stolen. Their path to wholeness runs directly through darkness rather than around it. The relationship between Bryony and Arrow defies conventional romantic narratives. Their connection isn't based on shared interests, compatibility, or even initial attraction. It's forged through trauma, violence, and a recognition of similar wounds. Yet by the novel's conclusion, their bond has evolved into something profound, challenging readers to reconsider what constitutes love. Arrow initially rejects the very concept of love. "Don't tell me you love me because I'll never say it back to you." He explains that what we have together isn't definable by a word created by another man. No combination of letters can encompass the magnitude of our tragedies. Love is beneath us. This rejection stems from his association of love with the bishop's abuse, how his abuser would call it love while violating him. Instead of verbal declarations, Arrow expresses devotion through protection, sacrifice, and a willingness to bleed. "I'd bleed out for you. I'd kill anyone so you could live. I'd follow you to your grave." His love language is violence, not directed at Bryony, but at anyone who threatens her. When he finally does say, "I love you," it comes after she has helped him reclaim his body from trauma. "I love you with every echoed beat of my dark and hollowed heart." Bryony's journey involves recognizing that conventional romance would never satisfy her awakened self. She initially sees Saint as the appropriate partner, handsome, respectful, destined for leadership. But her experiences with Arrow reveal the emptiness behind Saint's perfect facade and awakened desire she never knew she had. By the end, she embraces their unconventional bond. A connection like ours isn't meant for love stories. It's tragic and tarnished, full of dark desires that tradition cannot contain. The novel ultimately suggests that true intimacy comes not from conforming to social expectations, but from being fully seen and accepted in all our complexity, including our darkness. When Bryony tells Arrow, "Whatever way you love is the way I desire," she's rejecting standardized notions of romance in favor of a connection uniquely suited to their specific wounds and strengths. The novel's conclusion is deliberately ambiguous about whether the protagonist's actions constitute triumph or tragedy. They've achieved their revenge, exposed church corruption, and found each other. Yet they're also fugitives, perpetrators of extreme violence, and bound together in what they themselves describe as sick love. This ambiguity forces readers to consider what price is worth paying for liberation from oppressive systems. Material security is the most obvious sacrifice. By the epilogue, Bryony and Arrow are on the run, flying from city to city, Africa being their next destination on an endless mission for vengeance. They've traded stable lives for perpetual movement, comfort for danger. This physical displacement mirrors their psychological state. Having rejected conventional morality, they now exist outside normal social boundaries. Community is another casualty. While the church community was revealed to be corrupt, it still provided Bryony with connection and purpose. By choosing Arrow and Revenge, she isolates herself from all previous relationships except her brother Barrett. Their new life together is intensely intimate, but also potentially lonely, limited to just the two of them against the world. Most significantly, both characters sacrifice conventional morality. To achieve justice, they commit murder, torture, and manipulation. The novel doesn't shy away from the psychological toll this takes, particularly on Bryony, who must reconcile her actions with her continuing faith. While I've lost faith in humans, I still believe in God. This tension between faith and action remains unresolved, suggesting that liberation sometimes requires moral compromises that leave permanent marks on the soul. Yet the novel ultimately suggests these sacrifices are necessary when systems are fundamentally corrupt. "I don't care how we got here or that my life is in disarray," Bryony reflects. "All that matters is this man who's slithering his way into my heart, controlling its every beat." Her statement captures the novel's central proposition, that authentic connection and personal truth are worth any price, even if society would condemn the result as sick love.